You're listening to Writers on Writing, a show about the art, craft, and business of writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My guest today is Darrow Farr, a Salvadoran-American writer who was a Stegner Fellow in Fiction at Stanford from 2017 to 2019 and received an MFA in Creative Writing from the Michener Center at the University of Texas. She was born and raised outside of Philly, where she now lives with her husband and son. The Bombshell is her debut novel. On the show, we talk about why she chose her 17-year-old female protagonist and single point of view character until the ending of the book, the setting of Corsica in 1990, writing sympathetic villains, cribbing a bit from her life, keeping track, the title, and more. Here's my talk with Darrow Farr, author of The Bombshell. Darrow, I'm so glad you could join me on Writers on Writing. Before we get into the book, will you talk about your path to writing fiction?
Yeah, sure. So I think like almost everybody who's been on your show has said, I was an avid reader as a child. Mm. And I always enjoyed writing little stories, but it never felt like it was something that was going to evolve into a career. It just felt like a hobby. It was fun. It was for me. What I really wanted to do was work in fashion. I wanted to do something creative, but that also had a hint of glamour. So when I went to college, I majored in romance languages, thinking that that was going to help me as I traveled to, you know, France and Italy, having this fabulous career. And I took creative writing courses on the side, again, just for fun. And NYU, where I went, has an incredible undergraduate creative writing program. And they have this class where they invite an author to come and teach the undergrads. You have to apply to get in. And my senior year, it was Jennifer Egan. So I got into this class, which I was very psyched about, but I was not necessarily the best student. And she called me on the phone, which had never happened to me before, to tell me, like, you need to get your act together because you're a good writer and you need to take this class seriously. And I was like, whoa, you know, like, I'm a good writer, you know, I should take it seriously. Well, if Jennifer Egan is telling me that, then maybe I should. So this coincided with the end of the Great Recession. The job market was still not great. And I was graduating with student loans that I was desperate to defer. And also my boyfriend at the time was moving to California to pursue an MFA in film. And I just wanted to go with him. So saying that I was going to apply for an MFA just checked all these boxes. I really wanted to go to like UC Irvine or UCSD. Mm-hmm. So I moved out to California, but the crux or the chink in my plan was that I didn't get in anywhere. So I felt really bummed. And my parents were like, well, look, as a birthday present, we'll pay for you to take a workshop out there. So I started taking workshops at UCLA Extension, which like really changed my life. I studied with Lou Matthews, who has been an incredible mentor and friend. And he was really encouraging. And he was kind of the second person in my life who was like, no, you got to take this seriously. And so over the next 3 years, I applied twice more to MFA programs. So I overall got rejected twice for two cycles. I took a year off to like really hone in on my portfolio. And then the third time I applied, I finally got in somewhere. So then, you know, I went and got my MFA. And by that time, I think I had just wanted it so badly that I was like, this is what I'm going to do. Like, this is no longer an excuse to get out of adulthood. I'm going to really use this time to my advantage.
So what kept you going? Because typically writers who get rejected from MFA programs don't keep reapplying and they go, well, you know.
I guess delusion, like the idea that the people who are rejecting me must be wrong, that like I, and I was going to prove it to them. So, and I think it was really just the encouragement of my community. So through UCLA Extension, I found this incredible writing community that was super diverse. It was all people who had careers, but who were still very passionate writers and who were very talented. And I just had a lot of encouragement from them and was able to really elevate my writing by studying with them. And so I felt pretty confident. The last time I applied, I was like, all right, I like this story that I'm sending out. And if I don't get in, I think I was just going to keep applying until something did
mm-hmm.
happen.
Mm-hmm. Was that Bombshell?
No. So I started writing short stories, and it really didn't occur to me to start a novel until I went to the Tin House Conference. I had just finished my first year in the MFA, and there was an agents panel, and all the agents said, do not send us short story collections.
Mm-hmm.
Do not want to
Right.
see a collection. We only want to look at novels. And I was like, oh God, like I've only been writing stories. I thought I was going to have a collection at the end of my time here and turn that into a book. So I at that point was like, all right, well, I guess I got to write a novel. What's it going to be about? And so I didn't actually start the Bombshell until my final year of grad school. And my thesis was the first five chapters, which were very, very rough. But then I was lucky enough to be able to finish a first draft when I was in the Steigner Fellowship.
Interesting. Well, give the listeners a snapshot of the Bombshell.
So the Bombshell is the story of 17-year-old Séverine Guimard. She is the French daughter of a French politician and American heiress mother. It's 1993. Her dad has just been assigned prefect of Corsica. And so he brings the whole family from Paris to Corsica, which Séverine is not happy about. She is lonely there. She's bored. She can't wait to finish lycée and go off to start her career as this big Hollywood actress. And she just knows she's going to be famous. But before that can happen, she is kidnapped by this trio of militant Corsican separatists who spirit her off into the remote interior of the island. However, negotiations fall through and they end up being stuck with each other. So her kidnappers decide to try and re-educate her, and she decides to try and charm them into granting her some more freedom. And both end up succeeding to some extent. So she ends up sympathizing with their cause and also seeing a path towards the stardom she so desperately wants, and she joins their cell. And so then what follows after that is this summer of violence and romantic entanglements and possibly a revolution.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm curious because ideas are never in short supply for writers, right? I mean, you know, we have more ideas than we could ever possibly do anything with. Do you remember the moment or the day you knew that this was the one you had to pursue, that you had to write this story?
Yeah, so after I had this very sad aha moment at Tin House that I needed to write a novel, I was like, well, what can I possibly write about that will keep me engaged over a series of years? That was very daunting, the idea that it was going to take a long time to write a novel. And so I tried to think about the things that had kept my interest already for many years. And one was the Patty Hearst kidnapping, and the other one was the independence movement in Corsica. And I had kind of toyed around with the idea of combining these two things in the past. And I was like, well, it's now or never. You know, now's the time to do it for real.
Yeah, Corsica. I don't know that I've ever read any fiction based in Corsica.
There's a French writer named Jerome Ferrari who is very renowned over there. I think his parents are Corsican, even though he was born and raised in French, but he writes about Corsica and he lived there for a long time. And he won the Prix Goncourt, I want to say in the early 2000s, for a book called Sermon on the Fall of Rome. And that's a great book about Corsica. He has really wonderful books about Corsica, but there's only a couple of them that have been translated into English. So yeah, it's understandable that that hasn't really penetrated the US market. But if you want to check out more books about Corsica, he's a great, great author.
Interesting. I have a friend that owns a B&B over there.
No
that
way.
some sort of inn. I've never been. He's just like, come. And I'm like, I will someday.
You should go. You should go. I know it's far from California, but it truly is an incredible place. And it's so, so beautiful. And it's so uniquely itself. And I mean, that was what drew me to it.
Mm-hmm.
It felt like a surprise the first time I went there, which was when I was studying abroad in France, and I had fallen into this group of French friends, and my boyfriend at the time, who had Corsican roots, and his grandmother had an apartment there. He took us all there, and they had all been multiple times. You know, it's a common tourist destination for French people, but I was like, I had no idea that it was like this. And yeah, more as a romance language major, the thing that really drew me was the way that they use their indigenous language in Corsica to just kind of mess with French tourists and European tourists in general. They would cross out French street signs and rewrite them in Corsu. And I really was fascinated by that link between resistance and politics and language. And I wanted to study that, but never got the chance. So it went from being an academic interest to a creative interest.
So it's the setting is Corsica 1990s. Why the 1990s?
So initially, I was being historically faithful because the 90s was when Corsica went through its most fraught political moment, at least with regards to the independence movement. There was a scission in the movement, which just created a lot of chaos. There was this internecine feuding between these two scissions. Lots of people died. And it all culminated with the assassination of the prefect Claude Erignac in 1998. So I wanted to be somewhat faithful to that time period, but I knew from the beginning that I wanted to do a jump ahead into the future in the book. And so I started, yeah, I didn't want to write into the future because when I started the book, it was 2016. And so if I was going to write in the late 90s, that would mean that I would have to either write like in the present day of 2016 or even into the future. And I didn't want to do that. And I'm really, really glad I didn't do that considering, you know, everything that went down politically in the US in 2016. So I decided to bump it forward a few years so that I had a little bit of time to process the contemporary moment.
And why a 17-year-old girl, Severine, for as the protagonist? I mean, what went into choosing her as a protagonist?
She was there from the beginning. I had always wanted to write about a teen girl experience that was different from what I thought I'd encountered for most of my reading life. As a young reader who was reading YA and also, you know, adult books, I felt like the teenage girl who I encountered most of the time was somebody who was a little bit shy or unsure of herself. And her coming of age was her, you know, learning to have more confidence. And the experience that I had as a teenager was that I had this surfeit of confidence that I felt like I could do anything. And my maturity was being humbled. Like the world beat me down a little bit, which was necessary. And I figured that a teenage character is also a perfect revolutionary. I'm not the first person to think of this. I think history proves that that's true, that young people are the best revolutionaries. And so it just seemed like she was a perfect character to kind of push to her limits ideologically and also physically.
Interesting. Well, we soon find out that she'd rather stay with the kidnappers than go home. And although she does run away, but she ends up back at the house. So Stockholm syndrome is never mentioned. I don't think it's ever mentioned in the book.
No.
But when did you know that would be the case, that she would be on the side of her captors who have this political agenda rather than going home to her parents, whom she misses?
I mean, that was also always going to be the case. And here is where I did diverge somewhat from the Patty Hearst kidnapping. So, although that has kind of been the question that surrounds the Patty Hearst kidnapping from the beginning, like, did she join her kidnappers because she was coerced in some way, because she was doing it to save her own life, or did she join them because she felt a little frisson of excitement and she was truly converted? And I feel like it's pretty obvious that she was just trying to do what she needed to do to stay alive. But I wanted for my character to be somebody who really was the rebel in search of a cause that Patty Hearst had been described as. And so, yeah, from the beginning, I knew that she was going to have to be converted, not only politically, not only because she began to sympathize with the plight of her kidnappers, but that there had to be something else in it for her as well, something more personal.
The captors are quite sympathetic. You know, I mean, I found myself rooting for them, like, oh no. talk about them, because I think there's four of them, right? Or three. Four.
There's three kidnappers.
Three. Right.
And they each are representing different tropes, I guess, of like a politically engaged young person. So you have Bruno, who is the de facto leader, and he's sort of like the overeducated one, the intellectual, the one who has all of his theories straight. Then you have T2, who is the acolyte. He's a university student. He's unsure of himself. He's very sweet. He wants to be part of a group. And then you have Petru, who is sort of the legitimizing factor among them. He is the most quote unquote Corsican, the most quote unquote authentic. He's also somebody who was a soldier before. So he's bringing an expertise to the group that the other two lack. But I did want them to come across as sympathetic because you're going to have to spend a lot of time with them. And you're also going to see relationships develop among them, friendships, but also romantic relationships. And I didn't want it to be straight out revolting. I definitely expected the reader to be a little bit put off and hoped that that would be the case, but also maybe against their will to, as you said, root for them, to believe that there was some level of earnestness and genuine care that somehow arose from this really awful initial meeting.
So, you know, how did you develop them? I mean, do you do character biographies or, you know, and with Severine too, I mean, what sort of work did you do on them? Or was it a matter of, you know, writing, starting the writing and their character came to you as you were writing? I mean, how does that go for you?
For Severine, like I said, I always knew who she was going to be. And for her, it was mostly just making sure that I stuck to that. Because of her political conversion, she was somebody who I knew was going to start, you know, parroting the revolutionary speak. And I found that there were times that she was becoming a little dry. So I always had to bring myself back and be like, no, this is a bratty girl, bratty teenage girl. Like she's not the real, you know, she's a revolutionary, but first and foremost, she's just this bratty teenage girl. So, but as far as the other characters went, I did do character biographies after I found myself getting a little bit lost, finding that they began to resemble each other. I went back and was like, okay, no, I have to differentiate these men. Actually, I started with four men, and I combined two just in order to make it a little bit more intimate. And then, yeah, really tried to make sure that each of them felt like they were a distinct person who were going to be bringing distinct complications into this dynamic.
So I'm curious, you know, what sort of research did you feel that you had to do to write this?
A lot. A lot. And I had really, really wanted to spend time in Corsica, and it simply was not meant to be. I was able to go in 2018 off of a travel stipend that Stanford offered, which was really amazing. But I went for 10 days, and it wasn't enough time. I was able to get a sense of the environment and the places that I was writing about, ambiance. But I really wanted to go during the off season and just rent an apartment for a few months and take Corsu classes and develop a little routine. And COVID hit. So that was my first big obstacle. And then money was just an issue after COVID restrictions lifted. And then once I sold the book, I was like, great, I'm gonna use my advance money to go and edit there. And then I got pregnant. So it's this fantasy that I had of really ingraining myself in the life there just simply did not come to pass. So I ended up having to rely on texts. And so I read all sorts of books about Corsica. I read memoirs written by former militants. I read ethnographies. I read fiction. I read lots and lots of articles just about the politics and how the law works there, just really dry stuff. It felt like I was constantly in JSTOR.
Interesting. Yeah, because I was also thinking, could this story take place anywhere else?
I mean, I had definitely thought about that too before I had started writing it. And this is where the timing of it all is kind of funny because in early 2016, I was like, well, I could set this in the US, but I don't know if it would really fly. Like, I don't know if people, if readers would be really sympathetic to the idea of like a leftist militant group operating in the US. Post 60s, 70s. I don't know if people would really get on board with these characters. And so it felt like it was going to ease that it was going to bridge that gap if I set it somewhere else. But then, fast forward just a year, we're talking about the resistance. And I was like, okay, well, clearly, opinions have shifted. But I was really happy to be in Corsica while I was writing this book, mentally, if not physically.
Well, it's so great that you had been there, right? I mean, you'd been there, so you had that experience before you knew it was a book,
For
before
sure.
you knew. So that was, how lucky for you.
Yeah, definitely. I think if I hadn't been there, I would never have wanted to write about that place. It just was off my radar.
Yeah, I mean, I my you know, when my friend, when I learned he bought a Airbnb or Inn or whatever he did over there. And, I've always pictured it to be this very glamorous, kind of beautiful tourist destination without any politics or anything going on. Because who knows about Corsica unless you've been there, you've spent time in France. And
Yeah.
so.
I mean, there was, I don't know how many people heard about this, but the last time I saw it in the news in American news was, I think it was 2022, I want to say. The man who was convicted for assassinating Claude Erignac, Ivan Colonna, he was killed in prison, and it set off these enormous riots in Corsica, and Macron even said that he was going to reconsider granting them more autonomy after these riots happened. And it was one of those things where, yeah, because I was following all these Corsican news Twitter accounts, and I was like, whoa, this is making American news, but I actually don't know if the public really even heard about this.
I don't think so.
Oh, which also worked in my favor narratively because it meant that Severine, I don't know if this is spoilers, but she ends up hiding out in the US. And she's really able to do that because people in the US would not hear about, this event that happened in Corsica.
Well, I would love to hear you read from the bombshell. Will you please?
Oh yeah, I'd love to. I think I'm just gonna read a little bit from the very beginning. In the hours before her kidnapping, Severine Guimard claimed Antoine Carcenti's virginity in a grotto overlooking the Mediterranean Sea. She'd felt his eyes on her since she transferred to the Lycée Laetitia Bonaparte the year before. She knew she wasn't beautiful in the dark-haired, olive-skinned way of the Corsicans around her, but Severine was something to look at, with her sharp cheekbones and gold-washed hair and huge nose. It was a nose that belonged on the marble bust of a Roman senator, not a 17-year-old girl. Her mother always told her she'd look common without it, but Severine had convinced Papa to pay for a nose job as a combination graduation birthday gift, so long as she passed the baccalaureate next week. It was perhaps this one flaw that endowed her with a keen awareness of her body, how it moved beneath clothes, how to angle her face in overhead lighting, how to make people watch her. Admittedly, she also possessed a certain magnetism based on her father's position as prefect of Corsica. She'd been to the Élysée for dinner, and President Schneider had kissed her hello. She'd vacationed in Greece with the head of the IMF and his family. She'd even played pétanque with the mid-succession line Grimaldi on the beach in Monaco one time. But she did not feel like Papa's position and influence eclipsed her infant star. In fact, she was confident that she'd eventually burn brighter than him. She would be an actress, a very famous one whose poster teen boys would tack to their ceilings once she had her nose fixed.
Before we bring Darrow back on, a few words about Patreon. Patreon is how you can support the show and help us to continue bringing the show to you. There are perks, book giveaways, writing tips and prompts, the opportunity to ask questions of our guest authors, and more. Our Patreon page is at patreon.com/writersonwriting. Another great way to support our show and indie bookstores is by buying books at bookshop.org. Our affiliate stores at bookshop.org/shop/writersonwriting. There you'll find The Bombshell as well as books by other authors who've been on the show and books we recommend. Let's return to Darrow Farr. Your reading reminded me of what you said earlier, where she is a teenage girl, you know.
She has all the concerns and the vanities of a teenage girl, which I hoped that would create a lot of really fun conflict between her and her kidnappers once they become her comrades.
Right. You know. Yeah, I mean, so many great touches. I am curious about the point of view, because the story is almost entirely told in Severine's point of view until the end, when it shifts into one of her captors' point of views. Mm-hmm. And what prompted you to do that?
It was honestly just a hunch. As I was coming to that part of the book, I just felt like I needed to make this switch. I think it's this very pivotal moment. There's a reunion. And there's also, I don't know how much I want to say about
right.
the details of it. It's a really pivotal moment for all of the characters who are involved. And I just felt like I wanted to put it in the point of view of the character who was going to be most shocked and surprised. Mm-hmm. And I wanted the reader to experience that alongside him. And I also wanted to give him a chance, in his own words, to reflect on the last 20 years and to reflect on what had happened.
What happened.
Yeah.
It was quite poignant, actually.
Oh, I'm glad you thought so, because there was actually a lot of debate about whether or not it should stay.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, again, because I think both my agent and my editor said, I don't know, maybe we should switch this to Severine's POV. But because it had just been this illogical, irrational decision, it just felt like the right thing to do. I stuck with it. And I was like, let me finesse it. But I really do mm-hmm. think that this needs to stay in his POV.
Now, rumor has it that there's a little bit of your life in the book.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I don't know if that, it might just be a rumor.
Where'd you hear that rumor?
I don't even remember. You know, I was just looking things up about the book, and I thought I read something about something having to do with your father. No?
Yeah, no, it's true. You're a good researcher.
You're blushing.
Yeah, no, because I, you know, one of the benefits of writing about a character who does not resemble myself, writing about a situation I've never been in, writing about a place that I'm not from, is that there's all this built-in distance. And so it actually gave me some protection to write about some more personal things that maybe I know I couldn't have written about directly. And so one of them is that I too only met my biological father as an adult. I was in my 30s. And so it was a pretty melodramatic concept. I mean, even if the experience itself was strangely normal, it is a little soap opera-y to talk about. And so being able to kind of go through that experience, write about it, but put it in the minds and bodies of these other characters, really allowed me to kind of reflect on it a bit objectively, to make some changes based on the characters that I wouldn't have had the liberty to do if I were just writing, you know, a personal essay or autofiction.
Right.
And it ended up being very, very freeing, I think. And actually, it was funny because when I started the book, I hadn't yet reached out to my biological dad. So I got to this part and I was like, I'm such an idiot. Like, I've been building to this and I kind of have to do it now because the book is demanding it of me. It was one of those things that felt completely subconscious. And I was just like, well, I guess now's the time.
That's really interesting. I wonder if most writers do crib a bit from their own lives, even when they never talk about it. I mean, I think for me, I like that about fiction, that you can do that. You know, you can do that. You're not writing an autobiographical novel, but you're taking little bits and pieces from different parts of your life. And I think it makes the writing richer and more interesting in some way.
Yeah, I agree. And although there is a lot of autofiction that I really love, the idea of writing very one-to-one autobiographically does not interest me at all. It sounds very boring to me. And so writing a novel that's kind of high concept, and that, again, is about characters who really don't resemble me at all, I feel like I have more freedom to be indulgent about those like smaller experiences that I would like to write about and to just put those in.
Well, you mentioned earlier that you had four captors and you winnowed it down to three. Were there other changes that you made in the revision process or at any point that you're now happy you made them or regret? I don't know.
Well, the book was a lot longer initially. I think that I want to say it was like 160,000 words when I first submitted it to agents.
Wow.
And it is now maybe like 115. So yeah, I just have been cutting for ages. Like, I cut when I was first revising with my agent, like tens of thousands of words, and then I cut tens of thousands of words more with my editor. And honestly, I don't miss any of them. It was a little painful at times, but then I feel like the finished product is a lot stronger without some of those subplots. There was a lot more political machinations that were happening, which I felt like I needed to put in there in the interest of plot. And then when I was told, no, you don't have to do that, cut them, I was like, great. Like, I mean, I guess I just wasted, you know, weeks of my life thinking about it and writing it, but that's okay. Like, let me just get rid of it.
Do you keep an excerpt file? Do you have them somewhere if you ever want to do something else with them?
I do. But honestly, I don't know if they'll ever see the light of day. And that's
sure.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, how do you keep track of everything? I mean, do you, you know, when you're writing, do you have notes all over the place? Do you keep notebooks, project notebooks? Do you have like a whiteboard or post-it notes or an Excel spreadsheet? I mean, how are you organizing the material and just keeping track?
Oh God, I'm very disorganized. I do have just folders on my laptop that say, you know, chapter one, And then I have all the versions of chapter one that were ever in there. I have a folder that says notes, and I have just, again, random Word docs that might have character sketches, or I did once make a plot tree, which I somehow I lost track of. I ended up looking back at it and was like, okay, I didn't end up following that at all. How did that happen? And then yeah, just stray notes in my notes app on my phone, stray notes on envelopes, and I just for me it's like as long as all of that material finds its way in eventually and serves the book, it's fine. Like I don't need it to be archived in any kind of sensible way. The way that it is, that it was archived and organized, is just as it exists in the novel.
Did we talk about, I don't think we talked about outlining or plotting. I mean, how much did you need to know before you started writing? Did you create any kind of traditional plot or write out a synopsis, or were, are you more like, let me just start writing and see what unfolds?
A little bit of both. I obviously knew that she was going to be kidnapped and that she was going to end up joining the group. I knew there was going to be a romance, but I knew there was going to be, this final act of violence. But I wasn't quite sure how we were going to get to any of those places. And when I first started the novel, I felt like that was enough. Like I felt like I did have a pretty good outline, but then when I started writing it, I was like, no, the novel is everything that happens in between these huge beats. So I would go through phases where I was just exploring, and then I would go through phases where I was like, I'm never going to get anywhere exploring. Like I have to outline just chapter one or just chapter two. And kind of broke it down into smaller bite-sized pieces. And that ended up kind of being the most sustainable way for me to go forward. So I gave myself a little bit of latitude to be free, but then when I was too free, I could rein it back in.
I was just looking through the book because I was thinking that the inciting incident that writers are always told to get in pretty quickly is in your first chapter. And I wondered if the first chapter always kind of looked like this. I think it's toward the end of the chapter that it, well, it's a long first chapter, but that it happens and then she's at the place and you know, we know she's gone from her parents' property. Was that always the first chapter? Did it
Yeah,
always happen like that?
that's very perceptive of you, actually, because I think even though I edited this book so thoroughly, that first chapter was kind of barely edited. It sort of was, or it remained as it was almost from when I first wrote it. The only thing that got modulated was the kidnappers and their response to Severine, their treatment of her, because I realized that they were too harsh at first. And if we were to eventually, sympathize and care for these men who had just put a teenage girl in the trunk of their car, that they needed to be a little bit softer with her and more likable. But as far as everything that happens, that stayed the same right from the get-go.
Yeah, I like that they weren't typical, what you would think of as typical kidnappers, you know. I mean, they didn't hurt her. They, you know, there was no raping that took place. I mean, you know, all of the sort of tropes that go along with kidnappers were not here.
No, I wanted for them to come across as a little bit bumbling. I wanted them to come across as people who weren't entirely cut out for this business of kidnapping and being revolutionaries, even though their hearts were really in it. And I think there was this line towards the end when we're in Bruno's POV, and he's again thinking about how it all went down initially. And he sort of admits that they too operated out of emotion, that it wasn't this, like purely theoretical, purely ideologically motivated group that, you know, the reason that they kidnapped this girl was because they wanted to, one, you know, get a ransom, but they also wanted to release their friend who had just been arrested. And so their motivations were kind of born out of a sense of friendship and emotional desperation. So yeah, they're not your average kidnappers because they're not cold. They're pretty warm, maybe to a fault.
I loved the scene when she runs away.
Oh.
You know, and I was thinking that those kind of scenes are kind of difficult unless you've ever done that, gone somewhere like that and spent the night outside. And then what she runs into, I mean, there's something, I forget the word there. I guess there are some sort of statues or something on Corsica.
Meniers.
Meniers.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that.
So I had wanted that chapter to be a little psychedelic, a little trippy, a little bit like a nightmare, dream, nightmare scenario. And I, you know, really leaned into it at first. And it was perhaps a little bit too magical. But it was a good place for me to go to then like rein it in and to still leave you with this sense of nature being its own like pulsing, throbbing, sentient part of this place. And that her being out there is a huge part of her conversion. That it's almost like she is, you know, soft possessed by the spirit of the place. And I had a lot of fun writing that chapter.
And then she ends up back at the house. And again, where you would think that they would be upset with her and treat her badly, they're like, oh, we missed you. I missed you. I mean, it was just, you know, I love those twists in the book where it didn't really go how you would expect it to go, you know, that she would be punished, you know, but no.
Yeah, and I know that it stretches believability, but that was the fun challenge for me, was to try to make the reader believe that, yeah, the men would be like, oh my God, we've been looking for you. Are you okay? And that she's like, I missed you guys, you know?
Right.
So, of course, it does require some of the reader's cooperation. And I think you have to just like kind of accept that they're is an element of black comedy to this book. There's a little bit of the absurd, but yeah, the challenge for me as a writer and the fun of it was also just doing my best to make you believe it and just buckle up and be along for the ride.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm curious about, you know, in terms of the your process, if you have any rituals that you do when you're writing a book or before you write a book. I talked with an author last month who said that for every novel she writes, she always has to have two books, which she calls her scripture, meaning that she'll read those books over and over again, or they will, you know, inspire her or prompt her or remind her what she's doing. And so I was thinking just about rituals, how we all have, most of us have rituals. And I wondered if you had any.
Oh, I love that she said that.
Yeah.
I never thought of that as a ritual, but I definitely had my touchstones too that I came back to, like the Claudine books by Colette. Mm-hmm. As I was saying before, when I felt like Severine was getting a little bit dry and losing her rambunctiousness, I was able to go back to the Colette books and to say like, oh no, here's a character who has existed for many years in literature who embodies that rambunctiousness. But beyond that, I would say music has been very effective for me also in just maintaining my focus in maintaining the ambiance that I'm trying to create. But it's not consistent. Like I love music for when I'm drafting, but not while I'm editing. Other rituals.
And will it be music without lyrics or with lyrics, or it doesn't matter?
With lyrics, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think about it a little bit as a soundtrack to the scene. But I think that, you know, I don't I don't stay too dogmatic about any kinds of rituals because life changes and you have to roll with the punches. So, yeah, for instance, like I have a baby now. And so, what may have felt really important to me being able to write before, to have like these huge swaths of time, even if I weren't writing for the full, 5 hours or whatever, I needed that 5 hours in order just to like get into the headspace. Well, now that's out the window because my allotted time is a lot shorter. So I think if I have any rituals, they're going to be new and they're in development.
Well, speaking of the soundtrack, with the book your publicist sent, there's a postcard. And it says, and on the back, there's a QR code, and it says, I've made you a playlist, Severine. So, are they the songs that you listen to?
They are songs that appear in the novel for the most part. So I think there are only maybe two songs on there that don't appear in the novel. The team who I'm working with at Viking, they were like, we would love for you to make a playlist. And I was like, okay, like let me think about the songs that I was listening to. And then as I was just going through the book, I was like, I don't even need to bring in any of those things I was listening to because it's all here already. So I basically just transcribed the music mentioned in the book into this playlist, and I think it's kind of fun. Like it ended up being a pretty upbeat, like good summer playlist.
So, where would listeners or readers of the book find this?
On Spotify, I
On
believe.
Spotify? And they would put the title of your book, The Bombshell, in your name, or?
That's a great question. I will verify that and I will let you know.
Okay, that'd be great. Also, the title, The Bombshell, how far into the writing were you before you had the title?
That's a really good question. I don't quite remember, but The Bombshell was not the original title. It was
Oh, what was it? What was it?
La Bombas. So it's a not quite exact translation, but it was only, pretty recently changed. It was, I want to say, in the fall is when the title was changed. So I agreed because I understood where they were coming from. I really liked La Bombas as a title, and so did my editor and everybody else. Like that's the title that I sold it with. And it translates to, a bombshell, as far as like a hot woman goes, but it has the ASSE is a little bit of a pejorative. So anytime you see that suffix in French, it has a little bit of a snide association. So it's like she's a hot girl, but she's not quite right. And so I really liked that, but there were some concerns about just its memorability and people being able to recognize what that meant. And so I consented to them just anglicizing it to the bombshell. It loses that, ASSE snideness, but I think it's still okay.
And there's more happening with the title than just her,
Of course.
too, which is great, because what they're about to do, what their aim is, what the group's aim is.
Yeah, and so I liked that double entendre.
What about the cover? I mean, it's such a beautiful book, the colors and the design. And I wondered, at what point did you see it, or were you a part of creating it? How did that go?
No, so it was actually a long process that I was not involved in at all, and I'm grateful. It's designed by Colin Weber, who I think did an amazing job, and I'm just so happy with how it turned out. But I think it went through many iterations, and actually, this is part of why it was suggested that I change the title because there was just something about the title and the work that the cover had to do in order to make the reader understand the title and what they're getting into, that just ended up being too great a project. And so, yeah, it went through many, many iterations, and I ended up seeing a couple covers that I felt were like maybe not capturing the grittiness of the book and like the revolutionary kind of political nature of it. And so we ended up going back to the very first cover that Rollin had ever designed. And when I saw that one, I was like, that's perfect. And I'm sure that everybody was like, oh my God, no. We could have avoided months and months of this headache, but I think it worked out the way it was supposed to.
Yeah, it's really gorgeous.
Thank you.
It's really a beautiful cover. So we are at the end of our time together, and I wonder if you have any tips or words of wisdom for the writers listening.
I feel like my superpower throughout this whole entire process has been patience. So just patience applying for MFA programs, patience with, you know, making sure I put together a good portfolio. As I was writing the book, patience, because it took me 8 years from start to finish. And then when I was sending the book out, I also just waited for the right person, like just all through this whole entire process. Patience has felt like such a virtue, and I think I've been rewarded for that patience. So I know it's really, really hard, especially when you've been sitting with a project for so, so long, and you're just like, I just want to be done with this thing. I want to get it out. I don't even care anymore.
Right.
I feel like that's the moment at which you need to be like, actually, I'm going to wait even longer. Actually, I'm going to step away from it for a couple months, do something else, and then I'll come back to it. And that for me, at least, was what I had to do.
Yeah, it's so true. I mean, I think we're always so impatient. We need to get it out right away. We need to do, you know, now. It has to happen now. And I'm curious if you always have been patient. I mean, patient. Have you always been like that person who's like, you know, not needing immediate gratification? It's like, fine, I'll wait, you know.
No, absolutely not. I think that writing the book taught me patience. And so, yeah, I'm sure I'm going to have to remind myself of this as I start the next book. And I already, I'm like, what can I do to make sure that this process is shorter than it was the
right.
first time? What can I do to make my life easier the second
sure.
time around? So
who knows, right?
Who knows? Who knows?
Well, it's just been a delight talking with you, and so happy I read the book, and I wish you all the luck in with the book and with future books. Thank you
so much. Thank you for this really interesting conversation. I just love chatting with you.
Oh, you're welcome. That was Darrow Farr, author of The Bombshell. Thanks for taking the time to listen, and a huge thanks to our Patreon supporters who helped to make this show possible. You can check out our archive of shows at writersonwriting.com. You can find my Substack page on Substack at Pen on Fire. Thank you, Travis Barrett, for your music and sound editing. There's more typewriter music on Spotify under the artist Just My Type. There are no lyrics, making it perfect to use as background music for writing. Travis also has original music on Spotify under his name, Travis Barrett. If you'd like to get in touch, email writersonwritingpodcast@gmail.com. You can reach Travis at travisbarrettcreative@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening, and in the meantime, stay in the chair.